Well, that was something with Alex Jones. There you have it. Hey, a sarcophagus containing a 2,500-year-old mummy of an Egyptian high priest has been unveiled at an ancient cemetery south of Cairo. The sarcophagus was one of three from the 26th dynasty that Egyptologist Zahi Hawass, remember Zahi, and an Egyptian team opened during a special two-hour broadcast by the Discovery Channel. One was the well-preserved mummy of a powerful priest wrapped in linen, decorated with a golden figure depicting the ancient goddess Isis. Just amazing story, this archaeology. And in a moment, Dr. Heather Lynn joins us as we talk about evil archaeology, demons, possessions, and sinister relics next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Heather Lynn back with us. She was last on with me back in October of 2015. She's an author, historian, a renegade archaeologist, definitely on a quest to uncover the truth behind ancient mysteries. She holds numerous degrees and certificates in both history and archaeology, a member of the professional organizations including the American Historical Association, the Society for Historical Archaeology, Association of Ancient Historians, and World Archaeological Congress. She has left a life in academia to pursue this fascination with the unexplained and investigates ancient mysteries, lost civilizations, hidden history, ancient aliens, and the occult. Heather, welcome back.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me.
Good job with evil archaeology, by the way.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Hey, explain the little statuette on the cover.
That is Pazuzu. That is an ancient Mesopotamian demon. I put him on the cover because it was sort of this demon that inspired me, sort of inspired. I hesitate to use that word.
Inspired by a demon, huh?
Right. I mean, that's sort of what I look at in the book is this question of inspiration. Is that enough to constitute a step towards possession? But it was actually the movie The Exorcist. That the beginning scene of both the book and the movie is set in Iraq at an archaeological excavation. At the site, a priest archaeologist feels a strong wind blow, and it's foreshadowing the arrival of this demon Pazuzu, which is the demon of the southwestern wind and bearer of storms and drought in Assyrian and Babylonian mythology. And so this is the demon that's on the cover. As an archaeologist, it sort of piqued my interest and spurred me to question the relationship between demons of ancient Mesopotamia and now, because it wasn't long after seeing the movie play on cable reruns that I saw a news story that caused me to pause for a moment. On October 5th, 2014, sheriff's deputies in Clemens, North Carolina, raided a suburban home and discovered the remains of two men who had been missing since about 2009.
Oh,
at first, it seemed sort of sadly, as a run-of-the-mill news story, until I heard the name of the killer was Pazuzu. So before legally changing his name from John Lawson, it's Pazuzu. Yeah, he grew up in a picturesque suburb. He had a seemingly normal life, but he clearly struggled with what his mother said were mental health issues, and so he went on to recruit a brotherhood of other disenfranchised people that would go on to help him torture, murder, and then cannibalize local strangers and then bury them in the backyard of his home. So according to the psychiatric reports, the killer said he practiced a Sumerian religion that involved a monthly blood sacrifice, usually of a small animal, at least to begin with. He said he'd have to perform this ritual during what he called the Black Moon in order to appease the Sumerian demon and to honor Pazuzu. So this really just stuck out at me. I thought, so maybe Mesopotamian demons could sort of still be dwelling among us in some way. You know, to be clear, the killer is 100% to blame for his actions.
Sure.
So I just started thinking about, you know, what does it mean to be inspired? The word inspire comes from Latin, inspirare, meaning to breathe or blow into. And the word originally described when specifically a supernatural being imparted an idea to somebody. So this related then to the concept of doing something in the spirit of or in spirit. So it may be splitting hairs over the semantics, but it was enough to sort of then, I guess, inspire me to investigate the possible connections between the world of ancient Mesopotamian demons, the history of demons, and what their role is now in our current modern society.
Well, this individual was obviously whacked out, nuts, and insane, but he understood his ancient archaeology, didn't he?
To an extent, he was very much interested in it. He did flourish and embellish the sort of religious aspect of the Sumerian belief system. They didn't really have that practice in the way that he claimed, but he didn't really claim that it was historically accurate. He believed he was a prophet, for lack of a better word, that he was able to fill in those gaps for people and go on to make this religion, or at least try to start this mode of practice. And yes, he was clearly he had psychiatric problems. He ended up killing himself, or at least they found him in a pool of his own blood in the prison where he was being held. He said that he needed to do this Black Moon sacrifice. Otherwise, he was afraid that this demon, Pazuzu, would kill him. And they obviously, nobody was going to let him do something so heinous and ridiculous, but he insisted that his life was in danger. Well, sure enough, the next day they find him in a pool of his own blood with broken ribs, scratches all over his body, and he had basically bled out after having a scratch so deep that it perforated his brachial artery. So they ruled it a suicide. But
Heather,
tragic.
What do you think might have happened during the ancient days, way back, in terms of demonology and events? Did something supernatural occur, in your opinion?
I think something strange occurred. I guess we could call it supernatural or maybe supranatural. I think when you look back at history, specifically prehistory, it's difficult to obviously pinpoint it, but scientists do agree that there was something that happened in the brain. They call it the big brain bang, or sometimes just the leap. So something happened in our consciousness that sparked some sort of different way of thinking, some sort of religious, you know, thoughts. And people have all sorts of theories on what this was. Some believe it has to do with access to psychedelic mushrooms. Some people believe that it has more to do with how we started cooking food and releasing certain substances and whatnot. So there's many different theories, but we do know that at least scientifically, structurally, physically, something happened, and that something correlates with the religious experience and some of these stranger aspects of the religious experience, such as demons.
Heather, let's talk about your life as a renegade archaeologist. What is that?
Well, that's...
I can guess.
Well, I think for one, I was willing to come on the show after Alex Jones, even though I've received nasty emails all day about it. But I left the mainstream to pursue a fascination with these subjects that some people call fringe. Most of the topics you discuss every night here on Coast. As a renegade, I did not continue to follow the vocational path I was on in traditional academia. So I started out, you know, just the typical way, and then I started seeing things I just didn't agree with, and you know, I ended up reaching out to Michael Cremo, author of Forbidden Archaeology.
Yep.
Good, great, great, and he gave me some really helpful advice and inspired me to, you know, continue on and take all the tools that I could get from the ivory tower and bring them out and apply them to something a little more interesting, I guess you should say. But, you know, so I just basically don't blindly accept the word of academics and nor alternative or independent researchers. I think that the cult of personality is threatening the validity of alternative research. I think researchers of all backgrounds shouldn't position themselves as gurus rather than a scholar, because gurus seek followers and scholars seek challenges. So I think that through the respectful challenging of ideas, we can arrive at a more complete picture of the truth. And so, you know, a true scholar, in my opinion, welcomes the challenge because they see it not as a threat, but as an opportunity to grow closer to the truth. Especially today,
sure.
We need, you know, to work to create a strong public discourse about these sorts of issues, and especially when it comes to history. It's so important. One of my favorite quotes that really sums it up is from Orwell's 1984. It's, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." You know, that said, I believe the landscape of history is where the battle for our future is taking place right now.
One of the keys to your book, Evil Archaeology, is the underlined title, Demons, Possessions, and Sinister Relics. In your opinion, what are demons?
Well, it's There's a couple different things. There's the material aspect of demons, which I look at in the book. So I trace the artifacts and the material culture. And so you have these figurines like the one on the cover or any others, and you can trace sort of their evolution through time with events like religious syncretism, where people started to adopt these figures, rename them, put them with other ones, make amalgamations of them, and so on. And so you have these deities that generally look like horrible little creatures, or the devil, cloven hooves, this sort of thing. And that idea emerged years after the church was literally demonizing pagan demons. You can see this clearly in the case of Pan. The ancient Greek figure represented nature, fertility, music, and all sorts of fun. But eventually the church used the figure of Pan to illustrate what would happen to sexually immoral or uncivilized people. So Pan's horns and cloven hooves and this sort of thing proved to be the archetypal figure now of the devil. And so you can look at demons in that sense. And that's a lot of how people look at it. If you were to say demon, most people will conjure up an image of one of these chimera-like creatures with, you know, talons or sharp teeth. So that's one way of looking at it. But then there's another way of looking at it that goes beyond the material sense. And that's this idea of spirits and what does it mean to be inspired, and something that's unseen and possibly can take alternate shapes and this sort of thing. So I think there's two things at play. And I think the underlying thing is a very real phenomenon that people share. You know, I was speaking with Whitley Strieber last week about these sorts of things on his show. And he is very uniquely qualified to speak about this because of his experience.
Right. He's been there.
He's been there. And it's not one of those things where it's like, oh, these are little devils, or these are clearly just, you know, aliens, or this is something far deeper and far more entrenched in the human experience, that, you know, something as simple as saying a devil or whatever can explain. So I think what we're looking at here is a very unique but real experience that humans have had since the very beginning. And when we see these manifestations in the cultural and physical sense, like statues or paintings or drawings or whatnot, I believe these are the human's attempt to give face, or, you know, give a figure to these things that they are experiencing. And there's many different ways they can experience them. And I think that when we look at some of these cultural artifacts, while they're intriguing and interesting, sometimes they can distract from the underlying truth that is in the myths. And so I try to look at those truths, and I think that there's definitely something true there, and we need to sort of look at that more seriously.
And in terms of possessions, who's doing the possessing anyway?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and those are things that if you look at history, you'll find accounts of possession going back to the Neolithic era, not necessarily accounts, you know, prehistory, but there's evidence to suggest that these people in prehistory believed that they were being possessed due to some of their surgical procedures they would have on their head, one of which was trepanation. They would drill a hole in their head to sort of release these demons from their head. They did it for other reasons as well, to reduce intracranial pressure and in a lot of things that we can sort of guess at.
I hope they didn't drill too deep, huh?
Sometimes they did, sometimes they may have. So it was a very dangerous procedure, and no one was guaranteed to live past it. But surprisingly, a lot of people did. And so, you know, there's this idea that demons, and if you look at these chimera-like figures again, painted on cave walls, they could very well be demons or beings that are experienced in sort of a shamanistic trance. And so I think you could call those demons, you know, and if you wanted to. We don't know their intent or their malevolence or any of this, but we can definitely say that there was something that the shamans were seeing that were supernatural in some sense. So you have those prehistoric accounts, and then, you know, you can actually find accounts as far back in written history as 4,000 years with the Sumerian texts that discuss exorcism in great detail. A lot of them really, really are reminiscent of the exorcisms that we see now in popular culture.
So they go back that far?
They go back that far. Yeah, in the British Museum, they have medical textbooks from Sumer, a collection of about 1,000. And out of the 1,000 that they have, 660 of them reference exorcism. So they looked at it as a medical procedure and a spiritual procedure. They had all sorts of different ways of conducting this, but it went really far back. And, you know, I cover all this in the book, but it's pretty amazing that it's been something that we've sort of had with us this whole time. And so looking at that, I thought, well, you know, what about now? You know, I was brought up Catholic, and so my vision of an exorcist is, you know, a priest holding the crucifix and some holy water and this sort of thing. And so I challenged myself to look beyond that trope, and I actually found a modern-day exorcist and interviewed him in the book, Bill Bean.
Oh, Bill's going to join us, by the way, in a few minutes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, he's really great. He was very helpful in getting me to sort of see the modern context of exorcism and what exorcists go through and that sort of thing. And so it's very interesting. It started in prehistory, and we're still doing it today.
What did the Sumerians do to perform their exorcisms that it would be so different from, let's say, what the Catholic Church does today?
One method is actually maybe a little bit funny. It was the act of modeling clay figures of the demons so that they could have a battle. So they sort of had like a Rock'em Sock'em Robots thing happening, maybe. It was the priest would instruct the patient to make a figurine of the demon, and then the patient would raise his hand and say, "That unknown ghost, I have made a figurine of him." So again, it's this idea of taking these supernatural or unseen forces and materializing them somehow in this figure. And so then the priest would purify a clay pit. He'd put wheat flour into it, and the next morning would say, "I will buy clay from the potter's pit for a representation of what is evil. You pinch off clay and make figurines of the male and female witch." And then the patient would present those figures and pray that the demon takes the clay figure as a substitute.
By mistake?
And then he would leave his body. And so he would leave the human's body and go into this clay figure, because like attracts like. And so the ancient texts actually describe how to make these clay scapegoat figures. And so they'd be mixed with clay, tallow, and wax. And so you'd have to say a little thing three times so that the evil spirits would go into it. And so it was a little superstitious, but very interesting. And it was an ordeal, sort of.
Did they work?
They believe so. They really do. You see this. Now, let me say, the Sumerians, we all know by now, they were very meticulous in their record keeping and completely on the cutting edge of all science and technology. I mean, they knew so much. So these weren't sort of backwards people. They were highly advanced. And when you find these exorcist texts, they're not in a religious context. Again, they're in literal medical textbooks. And so they're treated within the body of scientific research, and they're treated very seriously. So they believed this was a valid method, and their experience and their belief said it worked enough that they would put it in their textbooks that they would go on to use to instruct the scribe scholars on how to perform these exorcisms and heal patients. So I think it could be argued that it worked.
Heather, where do people get the book Evil Archaeology?
It's everywhere. It's on Amazon. There's a Kindle audiobook and paperback, but it's also at all Barnes & Nobles, Books A Million, and in indie bookstores, too. So you can find it everywhere.
And Dr. Lynn's website, drheatherlynn.com. Drheatherlynn.com is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Her other book is called Land of the Watchers, but we're going to be back and we'll talk more about possessions and exorcisms next hour, of course. You're part of the program with your calls. And we are back with Dr. Heather Lynn. Her book is Evil Archaeology, Demons, Possessions, and Sinister Relics. And, of course, we're going to go to Bill Bean, a great spiritual warrior, in just a moment, and have Heather chat with him a little bit, as he was a key part of her book, Evil Archaeology. Is it safe to perform an exorcism, or is it safe on the person who's getting the exorcism, Heather?
Well, that's an interesting question, because in most cases, I would say that it's safe. But there have been accounts that, you know, of it being very dangerous. There's actually been people who have died during exorcism. So I think it's important to know who you're going to and what you're doing. And if that's something that you choose to do, you need to be prepared and vigilant about that. So, you know, there have been accounts of people being injured because it depends on the exorcist methods. Sometimes exorcists will do things like keep a person up with sleep deprivation for a long time, or keep food away from them, or keep them dehydrated. And clearly these are very dangerous things. But then you even have people who perform exorcisms who are licensed clinical psychologists who, you know, they believe exorcism can be sort of an important part of their practice. So somebody like that, perhaps, you know, it would be safer, arguably. So it really just depends. In terms of spiritually, that's another good question, because there is evidence to suggest that the exorcism itself on a spiritual level can be dangerous for the observers, dangerous for the person being exorcised. And those beliefs vary between different religious, you know, sects and stuff. So it can't be called safe. But there's definitely risks to it. I think it's one of those things where you have to look at the benefits and the risks and wonder which one, you know, may outweigh each other. I think medicine, again, exorcism was something that was considered a healing practice or a form of medicine. So just as if you took too many aspirin, you would, you know, not do so well either. So anything can be dangerous if done wrong or in too much of a quantity.
Having spent a great deal of my professional career in St. Louis, when I got there, I realized that one of the original priests in the original exorcism that was turned into the movie lived in St. Louis. And he was there when I was there. He died several years later, but he refused, Heather, to be interviewed. He just didn't want to go there. Whatever happened to him, I think, scared the living daylights out of the guy. And he was a priest.
Well, I've heard that a lot. Some of these, you know, people who experience this, they go in and maybe aren't quite prepared for the reality of what they're facing. And I think it would be hard for anybody to understand that perspective or where they're coming from if you've not experienced something like that yourself. You know, it's easy to just talk about it or observe things, but I think until you've experienced it, you know, it's really just talk. And so since I've not had an exorcism necessarily, I've witnessed an exorcism in the modern day, which is an interesting experience. But I didn't feel 100% prepared to answer the questions on modern day exorcisms. So that is why I contacted Bill to get his input on what it's like to do exorcisms in a modern day.
Well, Bill is a spiritual warrior. He's an exorcist. I'm going to bring him in now, Heather, and because he's a part of the evil archaeology work and research that you did, I'm going to have you conduct your little interview with Bill as you did for the book. He's with us. Hi, Bill.
Hi, George. Hi, Heather. George, thank you so much for having me back on.
Oh, it's great to be with you, and it was an honor to do a blurb for your book, Tom and I. You did
my honor, and I thank you both so much for it.
Stranger than fiction. But go ahead, Heather. Here's Bill.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great, Heather, and I hope you're doing much better as well.
Oh, yeah, I am, actually. Thank you so much for your... I really appreciate it.
We praise God for it. It was all him, and I'm just thankful that we were able to connect, and God was able to work through me to help you, and may that garbage stay far from you, and may you never, ever have another problem like that again as long as you live.
Well, thank you. And what Bill is referencing is the a bit of what I mentioned in the afterword to Evil Archaeology. I had to, you know, I approached the subject as scientifically as I could, but I had to then put in the afterword some of the experiences I had personally while researching and writing this book, some of which were harrowing, to say the least. And so it was quite a spiritual experience as much as it was just an intellectual pursuit. And, you know, being a spiritual warrior is something that I really sort of resonated with after reading about your advice and whatnot, Bill. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I praise God for it. And I just wish you all the best now. I pray that you can move forward in peace, freedom, and victory. And George, let me tell you, and you and I have talked about this before. When I wrote my book, Dark Force, many, many years ago, I was not the spiritual warrior. And in writing that book, right. I opened up some doorways, and I had to go back, you know, and relive some things. And let me tell you, some really strong supernatural garbage started happening around me. So when we delve into these things, and look, knowledge is power, and sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction. And when we delve into some of these types of things, doorways do open sometimes, and a variety of problems can happen as a result of that. And I think that Heather, unfortunately, went through some things that, you know, by her digging into this, and I commend her because, you know, she really did a lot of research into this, and I certainly commend her for it. But when we open some of those doorways, boy, oh, boy, you know, the devil and his minions will kick that door in, and then the trouble starts.
Heather, take about 5 minutes and chat with Bill as if you were interviewing him for your book, if you would. I'd like to hear your thoughts of a professional renegade archaeologist chatting with an exorcist. Go ahead.
All right, Bill. Let me just ask you a few of the questions that I did for Evil Archaeology. Sure. And this was one that was really important to me because I kept seeing it come up over and over again in my research. The difference between demonic oppression and possession.
Yeah, oppression begins with the victim being exposed to something. And usually, I'm sorry to say, trauma starts at an early age in many of my cases, and it's through child molestation or some type of rape or violent crime, something that causes a high level of fear and stress. It has to be something along those lines that is very traumatic that opens a doorway for that garbage to come in. Now, that said, not every case is like that, and there are cases that people have invoked the devil and his demons by the use of a Ouija board, seance, or provoking demons or inviting a spirit or a demon in. Believe me, when people do these types of things, the devil is going to respond, and that doorway will open, and then it's going to require somebody like me, God working through me, to get the garbage out and off and away from them.
So would you say that this happens when people, quote, dabble in the occult, or is this something where you've experienced people are actually trying to summon demons for some sort of malevolent purpose, or have you experienced both or
yeah,
neither?
Yeah, both. And, you know, there are so many people that have come to me from the paranormal field that are, you know, involved in ghost hunting and paranormal investigations. I can't tell you how many people, you know, in that field have come to me for spiritual help because they have opened a doorway and something has come into their life and has attached to them, and then it creates havoc in their life. So I've lost count of how many people have come to me from that area.
That's pretty dramatic.
Yeah. I mean, again, George, this is no joke. This is no game. And boy, oh boy, when that door opens, like I said, if there's a little crack, the devil will kick it in, and then it's going to start. And it'll be like the person is like under a curse, like they have a black cloud over their head. Nothing goes right. It's just one bad thing after the other.
Bill's website is billbean.net, B-I-L-L-B-E-A-N, billbean.net. Bill, thanks. Keep in touch with us, okay?
Thank you, George, and have a great one. And Heather, wish you all the best, and you guys continue to have a great show. God bless.
Good to talk to you, Bill.
He's a good guy. Good guy. He's been through a lot as an exorcist as well. I'm not sure I'd want to do that job.
Oh, no. I think it'd be emotionally exhausting, to say the least. He has to be very strong to be able to do that on a daily basis the way he does.
Well, that's what the other priests, they had two priests in the exorcist, the original one, and it almost killed him. I mean, it just drained him of everything he had.
I believe it. Yeah.
How many exorcisms have you witnessed, and of those that you have, how bad were they? How scary were they?
The only one that I witnessed firsthand was actually one that was done in South Carolina some years ago. It was frightening. I think frightening because I had no idea what to expect. As I said, I came into this sort of having a pop cultural reference to exorcism, thinking that what I'll see is, you know, just a, well, first off, let me just say, I didn't really know that I was going to see an exorcism. So that's always surprising, you know, if that gets dropped on you at the last minute, like, oh, I'm here to see an exorcism. So, you know, that made it a little more unsettling. So, but I didn't know what to expect. And so I'm at this church, it's a very small church. And, you know, the preacher was very exuberant. He was very excited. He ran around and jumped on the pews and, you know, so nothing completely.
Sounds like he needed an exorcism by himself.
And yeah, absolutely. But it, other than that, it was not completely unusual. It was just maybe a little excited and just, you know, that. So but then churchgoers started shaking and other people started uttering strange words. Sort of, they were speaking in tongues, so to speak. And then after this outburst, you know, I was distracted by watching that go on. And then he lifted his hands in prayer, and seemingly out of nowhere, a woman in a hospital bed was wheeled in. And she was wheeled in through a door from the pulpit, kind of like I hesitate to call it a stage, but the little platform, you know, where everybody's attention would go. And the preacher stayed there and continued to pray. And children were just rolling on the floor, speaking in tongues. Things got very excited. And at this point, I didn't really know what was going on. I'm more reserved than that. So I just stood there and watched, you know. And then the person who brought me to this event looked over at me and whispered, "Do you have anything to confess? Oh, we're going to do an exorcism." And I thought, I don't know. No, I don't know what confession has. Very confused. And so as you can imagine, I'm just in awe of what I'm seeing and in anticipation for what's going to happen next. And so, you know, I was a little skeptical, but people started running around and jumping. It was not like anything that I would have considered to be an exorcism from my point of view, because it almost seemed like a revival or some sort of party. And then the woman, the woman in the hospital bed, she starts moaning and writhing. And from the same door where she was wheeled in, they brought in a procession of four live goats.
Oh, really?
As goats, yeah. And it was very strange. At that point, I thought, okay, this is getting real. What's going on? And so, you know, the goats are just walking aimlessly through the church and you know, no explanation for that. And so everybody was seemingly was joyful in a strange way. It felt as though, and I don't mean this in a spiritual sense necessarily, it's just an observational sense. It almost felt like everybody in the church had a need for an exorcism. It was just an all-encompassing sort of mass event. But the woman in the bed, she started shrieking at this point, and her face got so red, I thought she was going to have a stroke. But her vocalizations became really weird. They went from glass-shattering shrieks to just these growls and just back Jeez. And forth and back and forth. And the only word that she would utter was, "Aloo." And so the preacher asked, "Demon, what is your name?" And to which the woman just responded, "Aloo." And so this continued for about an hour. Again, we're talking about exhausting.
It is exhausting for both sides.
For all sides, everybody. And so, you know, gradually people started getting a little quieter and some of the children started falling asleep on the church floor. The preacher never left the woman's side. And then just out of nowhere, as if just awakening from a fever-ridden sleep, the woman sat up. She put her arms around the preacher and gave him a really big hug. When she pulled away from him, there was this clarity in her eyes that just wasn't there before. And all the members of the congregation were alert to this, and they started clapping and cheering, and the energy sort of came back, but not the frantic energy that there was before, more of a sort of a celebratory, relieved sense of energy. Meanwhile, these goats are still walking between the pews. Still, the goats. I'm like, okay, there's goats. And so the woman in the hospital bed, she gets up, and with the help of a few other people, she walks into a meeting room that's adjacent to the main area where the exorcism had taken place. And so everybody, including me, we gathered in this meeting room, and we were offered punch and cookies, and it was sort of just an average, you know, church night. And there was a step-in bathtub that they used for baptisms. And the preacher escorted the exorcised woman to the tub and baptized her. It was sort of a little after-party, which continued for another hour or more.
Gee, but the baptism wasn't screaming and yelling or anything like that?
No, she was very calm and subdued, and again, with the clarity in her eyes. That was what was striking to me, was that at first it seemed that she wasn't even there. And then after this happened, she just had this way about her, like she had woken up from a spell. And again, this whole event probably took about 4 hours. So it was quite exhausting.
All right, Heather, we're going to come back in just a moment, our final hour with you, and we will take phone calls with regards to demons and possessions, Heather's book, Evil Archaeology, and we will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.